This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Harry's.com. Go to Harry's.com/Duncan, and you can get a free Harry's razor for only $3 shipping. Let's shave our bushes. It's spring. Happy Bicycle Day, everybody. It's April 19th, the day the first intentional dose of LSD was taken by Albert Hoffman.
Some children see him lily white, the baby Jesus born this night. Some children see him lily white, with dresses soft and fair. Some children see him bronzed and brown, the Lord of heaven to earth come down. Some children see him bronzed and brown, with dark and heavy.
My sweet children, I don't need to tell you that we live in a magical world. It's an incredible place where, from time to time, emerging from the nothingness, a Messiah appears. We know this for certain. We know that there was a time when there wasn't a Siddhartha Gautama, a Buddha, a Tathagata. We know that there was a time preceding the Buddha. And all of those moments when dinosaurs were attacking each other and single-celled organisms were floating in the briny pools of some primordial earth, everything was moving towards that event which would produce the Buddha. Everything, just like everything was moving towards the event that produced you, the entire world conspiring at a biochemical level through inhalations and exhalations of strange creatures that don't exist anymore, wiped out by meteors. Some of them may not even have a terrestrial origin. But every single movement on this incredible planet, every calorie burned, ultimately led to that incredible event, which was the birth of the Buddha, the birth of the Christ, the birth of Muhammad, the birth of Martin Luther King, the birth of Albert Hoffman, and of course, the birth of you, my sweet listener. I love the story of LSD. It's amazing. I love the way that God appears on this planet, because we do have a planet where God appears. I'll call it God. You call it whatever you want. And the way God appears is amazing, perfect for the time. This is the story of Vishnu. Vishnu comes down when things are out of balance and repairs the imbalance in always the most perfect way as a response to the times. And what better response to the material world? What better response to a time when humans are deeply fixated on the atomic structure of things, and from that understanding, creating weapons of such horror that they could actually destroy the entire planet? What better time to rebalance things? What better time for the appearance of some kind of Messiah? And think about it. If Buddha appeared now, in the way Buddha appeared so long ago, some Indian prince, what would happen? He'd probably end up having some kind of, at the very best, like a YouTube channel. There'd be people who thought, man, this is really cool, but I've kind of heard this shit before. I don't know, New Age dude, I don't buy into that yoga crap. It wouldn't necessarily work. Certainly if Jesus appeared now in the form that he appeared way back in the day. There was never a Jesus. Get the fuck out of here. You loon. Of course there was. Now what he was and what which part of the multiverse he appeared in, who cares? What sphere of subjectivity he emerged into, it doesn't matter. The point is, if that being appeared today in that form, same thing. We'd be like, well, I don't know. He seems pretty cool. But he certainly wouldn't have had the crucifixion experience. And if he did, it would be something that happened in the lands of Isis, and there'd be no real record of it. So Vishnu appears in this material universe at just the right time, according to the archetype, and in just the right way, speaking exactly the language that the people need to hear. And so, on April 19th, 1943, the incarnation of truth in the form of LSD had a conversation with Dr. Albert Hofmann. And that conversation resulted in a cultural shift in the subjective transformation of millions of human beings, transformed not by reading some scripture, not by sitting at the feet of a guru, not by witnessing some external miracle like a healing or walking on water, but by taking a tiny, 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 tiny amount of a extraordinarily powerful chemical and entering into an 8, 10, maybe 12-hour state of consciousness that allowed them to, at least temporarily, escape from the confines of their ego prisons and realize what's important and what's not important. This, of course, is what the prophet always does. The prophet appears, the prophet sets things right, the prophet explains to you the forgotten way, and upon remembering the forgotten way, you begin to walk it for a little while. Maybe you don't successfully stay on the path, but shit, man, just a few hours being in tune with things again can affect you for your entire life. So, April 19th, truly a high holiday. And interestingly enough, a great many of you might be listening to this podcast using a bit of technology created by a devotee of LSD. Here is a quote by the late, great Steve Jobs. "Taking LSD was a profound experience, one of the most important things in my life," Jobs said. "LSD shows you that there's another side to the coin. And you can't remember it when it wears off, but you know it. It reinforced my sense of what was important, creating great things instead of making money, putting things back into the stream of history and of human consciousness as much as I could." Happy Bicycle Day, everybody. We got a great podcast for you today. We're going to jump right into it. But first, some very quick business. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the glorious Razor Dwarfs. Forging powerful, beautiful razors in the deep subterranean caverns of Harry's.com. Why shave with a crappy plastic blade when you could shave with something that feels like it should be named? Like something that comes from a chest in Lord of the Rings. You should feel like you're going to name your razor. When you're shaving your pubes, do you want to use some blasted, cursed, crappy plastic shit razor that's going to end up in a dolphin's blowhole in only a matter of time? Or do you want to use something glorious to give respect to that forest of doom that has sprouted up around your precious genitalia? Guys, we got to shave our pubes, man. Spring is here. This is a great deal. If you go to harrys.com/Duncan, you will get a free trial set. They'll send you a free razor for only $3 shipping and handling. And that includes 5 blades, shave gel, and a weighted razor handle. It gives you an incredible shave. You want to get that Westworld getting shaved by a android cowboy barber feel? Go to harrys.com. It makes a big difference. It really does. If you or someone who grooms your beard like I do. For some dumb reason, I like to shave right around my cheeks. I don't know why. If I don't, the hair goes into my eyes. It goes over my entire face, and I become a proto-hominid thing. So I got to shave around my cheeks. That's what I do, and I like the way that Harry shaves. Look, I'm not going to go into I should do a 30-minute razor commercial because razors are important. I got suckered. You know, I broke one of my number one rules. I went to some crap drugstore and I bought something off the Home Shopping Network. This razor will last a year, is what it said. And I took it home and it's shit, man. It's like a dad razor, if that makes any sense. It's like some crappy, ugly, safety orange shit razor thing. Like something that you find moldering in a pile of old shaving cream in a dad's shower. It doesn't even do the job. It leaves like weird black dots in my face. Not blackheads, but it kind of looks like that. It just doesn't work. It's like when I'm done shaving, I want to look at my face and feel like it's unicorn skin. And if you use a great blade, it makes a big difference. So try out Harry's. I wouldn't lead you astray. I use Harry's. I love Harry's. I just spent $15 for a Harry's razor at a hotel. Wish I'd known about this deal, which I didn't know about. Gives you a great shave. It's fantastic. You're going to love it. And really, I don't know exactly how you could go wrong with this. You will show your support for the podcast and love for the DTFH, and also you'll get a fantastic razor for $3. That's an incredibly good deal. Give it a shot. Go to harrys.com right now, /Duncan. Order your sacred blade of shaving, a blade of a fucking Vorpal razor +6, a sweet weighted blade with which you could gently and daintily shave around your pubis, forming a spring shape, whatever it may be. Pentagram, I don't know how you like to shave your pubes. Shave your butt. Let's get the hair off of us, guys and gals. It's time to shave down. Go to harrys.com/Duncan. For only $3, you are going to get a free razor blade. That's insane. These are really good blades. I wouldn't pitch it if I didn't love them. Harrys.com/Duncan. Do it today. Clean up your bush. I've got some shows coming up, friends. I kind of messed up, and I didn't realize that my Facebook wasn't posting onto my website. So one of the dates that I've been talking about for the last few episodes and saying, oh, the link is going to be at DuncanTrussell.com, it hasn't been there. And that's the show at Starburns Castle, April 27th. That's Thursday in Los Angeles. I'm going to be doing some comedy at Starburns Castle. That's the Feral Audio Theater in Burbank. I hope you'll come. Ticket links are at DuncanTrussell.com. I'm also going to be at the Independent in San Francisco. Hurry up and get tickets for that. It's almost sold out. And I'm going to be at the Bell House on May 16th doing a live DTFH. These are fun shows. I hope you'll come out. There's lots of great ways for you to support the DTFH, my sweet friends. Come and see me at a show, check out one of our sponsors, or use our Amazon link located at DuncanTrussell.com. I just got one of these Amazon Echoes. I know it's embarrassing, but they are cool, man, especially if you're getting into cooking and you want to like yell out timers. It is really, really cool to be in the kitchen and to yell out, Alexa, set timer for 7 minutes or whatever. It's great. You could set a billion timers. They're super cool. Sure, it may be a portal through which the CIA is monitoring every single thing that we do. But hey, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And if becoming a willing member of some kind of futuristic dystopian police state means I don't have to pick up my iPhone to set a timer for my ground beef, so be it. All you got to do is go through the link located at DuncanTrussell.com, and anything that you buy on Amazon, they will give us a very small percentage of. You can bookmark the link. You don't have to keep going through it. Just give it a shot, won't you? And for those of you who continue to do it, my thanks to thee. Thank you to all of you who have been donating to the podcast. I really am amazed by your generosity. And also, we have a shop located at DuncanTrussell.com with t-shirts and posters, and we got some new merch coming in. I've started working with a company called Merch Table, and so we're going to be making some new amazing merchandise. That's right around the corner. So there it is, guys. All right. Today's guest is one of my oldest friends on planet Earth, and he has an incredible podcast out right now called Drifter's Sympathy, which is on my network, Feral Audio. And the episode that he just released, Insidious Mind Control, for the first time ever, a bunch of prank calls I did with Emil in college are now available for your enjoyment. These have never been released in one podcast, and some of them I haven't heard since college. He edited them, he cleaned up the sound. They're really cool. I get really nostalgic listening to it, but I think you'll enjoy it. So when you're done listening to this episode, check out Emil's podcast, which is amazing. All the episodes are really cool. It's a really, he puts a lot of work into it, and it's beautiful. It's called Drifter's Sympathy, and you can subscribe to it at Feral Audio. Emil also has a big tour coming up. I'll have a link to all the dates in the comments section of this episode at DuncanTrussell.com. Okay, everybody, rip open those third eyes, inflame your chakras, and spray some karmic redemption juice into the boiling brain of my dear friend, Emil Amos. Emil, welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. It's been too long. People have been requesting your presence on the show. What do you have to say for yourself?
I don't know. We just, you know, it's weird. We try to have this rule where we don't talk before we start recording. And we just talk for 3 hours.
I know. And we covered a lot of very important ground.
Yeah, really salacious stuff.
I had no idea. Emil is like one of, I had no idea that you have a pretty like renowned collection of butt plugs.
I didn't know you could have said anything.
You know, there is somebody out there, I would bet $1 million. Mm-hmm. There's someone out there who has a renowned collection of butt plugs that like...
But watch this. Listen to the tone of my voice. Do I sound like that person?
Yes!
I don't.
No, I know you don't. I'm just kidding. But it's funny to think, like, I guarantee there's a person.
They're like, oh, this is right up my alley, this one.
Yeah, like, because I was just reading, I don't know how I happened upon it on the internet, but, you know, it's like a... pinball machine, I think it was on Reddit, or I don't know where it was, but a pinball machine called Punks. And it was like, it's a very difficult to obtain pinball table. Only 1,000 were ever made. And like in the, all over it are like, they're alluding to different bands because they couldn't say the name of the band without having to pay them. So, but it was just interesting to read, like, I guess you would call it a pinball file, like whatever that would be, someone who's into pinball tables, commenting on how it doesn't look like a very good board, but it's incredibly difficult to obtain. Only 1,000 of them were ever made. And so it's just funny, that collector instinct and knowing, oh, if that's true for pinballs, it's true, pinball machines, it's true for everything, mm-hmm. including butt plugs. Like, there's got to be a person who's familiar with all the brands. I don't know why I talk about butt plugs so much. I only have one.
Well, it's funny because when you said that word and then you went to pinball... Two of those, they both like take me right back to, I think there's probably people out there that are like, oh great, they're going into the past again. But one thing it took me back to is like, one of the reasons why we met, I've talked about this maybe once, but one of the main reasons why we met and one of the sustaining things of interest for us for some dumb reason was we were both obsessed with the Funhouse pinball machine.
The best.
In the basement of the cafeteria called Gladfelter. And so we would go out around Asheville, right, and we'd go play Elvira down at the down at the fucking head shop. And the head shop was called Octopus's Garden. It's probably still there.
Yep.
And the feeling of just sitting around in that head shop with the kind of like, you know, the beads that jingle when you walk through the door. They had, I think they had the Twilight Zone and they had Elvira. And anybody knows, it just kind of gets in your head, the sounds and the repeated lines and the like
weird, sure.
The sounds when you hit the flipper.
How about this? Listen, check it out. You don't even have to say it. Look at this. Pro here, we got it right here. Listen to this.
Obviously, like sounds of something like that, they come along with this heavy symbolism and connotation of your life. Like when I was a kid, 6 years old or something, my dad would take me to this seaside shack in Coconut Grove, Miami, Florida, and it was a bar called Captain Dick's, and we would walk in.
How old are you?
I was probably six.
Okay.
And we walk in and everybody just sees him and they just light up because he just was like this folk hero in Miami. And they had Arkanoid and they had whatever, like, you know, the particular games that they would have, and like all the fucking people at the bar all look like cannibals and like just really fucking scary people to a 6 year old.
Sure.
Anybody drinking a beer looks like a serial killer.
Yeah.
but you know, those memories, they come along with the sounds. When you hit a flipper on a pinball machine, it says something like, "Who am I?" You know, the Frankenstein, Mary Shelley machine yells, "Who am I?" You never forget that sound,
right,
for some reason. Anyway, so when you said butt plugs and pinball or whatever you said, it took me right back to that place, because we went into the Octopus's Garden and we would go down there because you were bored, and Asheville was a ghost town, right? So we would go down to, I think it's called Lexington, is that
street? Lexington Avenue,
and we just walked down the middle of the street because there was no cars, there was nothing to do.
Yeah.
It was just that endless lazy Sunday, and we'd jingle through those beads and we'd sit there and you'd hear those sounds, and there was something so comforting about those sounds, and something so comforting about the methed out lady behind the counter.
Octopus's Garden, can I help you? That's one of my favorite prank calls we did.
Well, that's where I was going, is that I still haven't released these prank calls. We still haven't released them, but like, it's one of my episodes coming up. I just keep bumping it back because I want to like set the context for it. Because, you know, it was our major bonding point in college. I wouldn't say it was the central bonding point, but it was like, it was a tangential world we would step in. It would be like, I think there would be sometimes like 10 minutes before class and you'd be like, "Let's do a call." It was like this weird tangential universe, you know?
Oh, dude. I mean, I can remember discovering that we could do this with your handheld tape recorder and the excitement, because it was like, oh my God, this is like working. Like, this is creating these moments that are so funny and so like ridiculous and totally safe because of the switchboard. Because they couldn't trace the call back to us because it had to come through that switchboard. So
even at the time, I mean, we could have gotten arrested or something.
But they would have had to have, like, there's no way to do it because they would have had to have gone. You trace a call, it goes back to Warren Wilson College. It doesn't go, I'm sure now maybe the rooms probably you could trace it back. But in those days, it goes to the switchboard. And I remember one of our friends worked security. And remember he said he got a call because somebody was like, you know, someone's making prank calls from your college.
But it's like a really vague, old-timey switchboard, so the numbers just got dispersed into this Bermuda Triangle. No one could find out where they were coming from.
And even if they could, even if, you know, they got to the security, the students worked security, so no one's going to snitch on you for doing prank calls. And even if they did manage to get back to you, like, what offense is it really? Like, doing a prank call in the, what was that, the 90s? Doing a prank call in the 90s? That's no offense. You can't arrest. No one's like, there's no images of someone getting dragged to jail or arrested.
Well, they came to my house. Somebody came to my house once when I was a kid because I used to do it. Did you do them before we did them as a kid?
I think like just like, you know, any kid does like the really stupid ones where you just call a random number and you're like, oh, I made a fart.
I called this one kid and his mom was on the line the whole time. You know, that old thing where like, someone always also be on the line and you couldn't quite tell from another room. And she heard the whole thing. And like, I went drastically off color all of a sudden. I said something like really offensive at age like 10. And they showed up at my house like 20 minutes later. But that never happened to me and you. We got in a lot of trouble.
Wait, the cops came to your house?
I think it was maybe his mom and him, like, pulled up. Like,
God, that kind of trouble you could get in when you were a kid is so crazy. The kind of trouble, kid trouble?
Yeah.
Like, and also...
Can we call the podcast that?
I mean, right now I'm stuck between butt plugs and pinball or kid trouble. But maybe we'll give it two titles because... Because that's what they do. But, you know, man, like, this is a really, like, fascinating, you know, so many things are going extinct every day. Another fucking animal goes extinct. An industry goes extinct. A tiny little way of life just vanishes from the universe as we progress into the future, down the time-space continuum. All this shit falls into the nothingness. And people live, you know, probably a lot of people listening to this right now, they never had a rotary phone, you know, and they never had to do that thing. And they certainly never had the experience. I mean, a lot of people don't have phones at their house, much less two phones, much less when someone calls your house, all the phones ring, or you have to get a special stretchy fucking cord so that it reaches really far so you could sit in your chair and you don't have to stand in the kitchen. Nobody had that. No one had to go to the like drugstore to buy a long cord that stretches into the fucking to your chair. No one had to do that or knew the convenience of finally getting the stretchy cord so that you can sit in the chair or you pull a chair from your table near the phone. But also nobody knew the problems you could run into with this relatively archaic technology. Like, for example, I remember I was at my dad's house and I know he listens to these, so sorry to, I guess I'll confess now, Dad. It's so bad. I didn't mean to do it. I was just in his bedroom. The phone rang. He got a call. I lifted up for no reason. Bored. You're bored. You're just a kid. You're bored. You're like, I'll just listen in on this call. Lifted up the phone. I'm listening to some boring business call my dad's doing. But then I accidentally pressed a button on his answering machine. So it goes, and the guy, there's a long pause. And the guy on the other line goes, Julian, are you recording me?
Oh, man. You reminded me of some terrible shit I did, too.
My dad's like, no. I mean, he isn't. He's like, no, I'm not recording you. No, of course I'm not. What are you talking about? Meanwhile, I'm in the back room, like, in horror. Like, what am I going to do? Because I think I was legitimately recording the guy who now probably has a perpetual mistrust of my father because it was exactly the sound you would hear should someone be recording.
Yeah.
But these are the things that are lost. You know, they're lost.
So sad.
The ability to lift up the phone and like sneakily listen to someone else's conversation.
You know one thing that never goes away?
What?
Just the ability to walk out in the woods and just start an old-fashioned forest fire. Just go out there and just light her up. You know what I mean?
But in the old days, you know, the technology to trace the forest fire is so much better. Now, I'm always amazed that they catch people who start forest fires. You know, it's like, well, how? But it's like they have who knows, cameras at the trailheads, or they have some way of like, well, we saw some strange boys at the drugstore. Like, they have ways of pinning it on people. This is something, you know, I think about a lot, is like how easy it must have been to murder people just in the 60s or the 50s. Like, you now, the technology, the forensic technology they have is so advanced. The ability to, like, you know, it's like you watch Forensic Files and you never want to try to kill anybody because it's like, oh, they're definitely going to catch you. They find a granule of dandruff. Oh, we found one tiny piece of dandruff had landed on top of the dining room table, and a forensic analysis traced it to a special kind of Pert Plus that was only available from this store, which, you know, it's like insane that they, but in the old days, man, you could just fucking, you could just go to somebody and be like, hey, can you help me carry these potatoes into the woods? Walk like 15 feet into the woods, club them with a rock, walk out, and nobody would know. Those days are gone.
I had this one babysitter named Cindy, and have I told you the story?
No.
I only told somebody this once, and I thought maybe it was you. But you know how you had these bonds with your babysitter? Like, there was always like a potential sexual region.
Yes.
Of like, well, you know, the parents are gone. We're watching TV. Do you want to play Nerf basketball? What could this lead to?
Right.
You know, there's always some sort of weird vibe, you know, but there, or a sense of trust, hopefully. I don't know. I never had any disasters, but I had this one.
What do you mean disasters?
Or just like abusive babysitters.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure people have stories, but mine were all pretty chill. Local legendary babysitters. And so this one was Cindy. She was kind of your classic, like, 80s nerd, you know, with the short hair and the huge glasses.
How old?
Like, kind of, I don't know. She must have been in, like, sixth grade, and I was, like, in third or I don't know.
Okay.
I can't remember. And I remember sort
of... Sixth grade seems young for a babysitter.
It seems crazy young, so maybe I'm wrong about this, but
I think babysitters are usually, like... You know,
well, I was a single mom, so I had to be looked after from as early of an age as possible for her to just go out on a date.
But still, your mom's not going to like, think of a sixth grader. Sixth graders are like, they're, you know, they just learn to walk, right? They're barely, you know,
I think that might be part of the story. Like, I saw her, she was straight out of one of those like John Cusack movies where she's just like the archetypical, like, hardcore nerd.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand what a nerd was yet, right? Because, like, I was still young enough that everybody was on the same playing field. And then one night I was walking home from, like, the railroad track shortcut, and I passed by her bedroom. Coincidentally, she lived, like, a block away. And so in the window I could see her, like, with, like, a microphone or, like, a fake microphone. And she was, like, dancing around like she was, like, a star, you know. And she was singing, like, something, like, super sad, like, Girls Just Want to Have Fun or something.
Oh, shit.
And she was going crazy, you know, dancing around and singing her heart out. And in that moment, maybe I sort of understood what a nerd was. I was, like, I could feel the loneliness just fucking emanating outside of the bedroom.
Right.
Like, something I hadn't yet perceived.
You think,
yet.
Like, I'm sorry, but why? I guess I just don't ascribe deep existential loneliness to sixth graders. Like, the thing, like, but that's probably a misunderstanding of kids or something. Like, it's hard for me to, I guess, yeah. When I was in when I was in the sixth grade, even before that, I mean, I can remember the confusing horror of the third grade, and certainly the rottenness of the second grade, and then the sort of misery of the fourth, and the subsequent boredom of the fifth, and then like the intermittent divorces and moves. And okay, yeah, so I get it. Yeah, you can be completely wrecked as a sixth grader, I guess.
Well, that's what I'm saying is, like, partially I was coming into the knowledge. Like, I was still living this happy-go-lucky life. You know, maybe a dog bit me once. Whatever. So looking back, I'm piecing together somebody's personality, their psychology, with all this, like, with all these other facts that I, you know, at the time wouldn't have known. Like, I have this other weird memory of watching her, seeing her walking home from school, just weeping.
Ah, fuck.
With her, like, backpack on, and in a moment, just realizing what, like, how cruel kids really are.
Right.
You know, and seeing, like, oh, man, Cindy's not cool. Like, Cindy walks home fucking crying because people probably, like, roast the shit out of her in the hallway. You know, God knows what they said to her. But you see, from the beginning, I thought Cindy was, like, older and fucking cool. But so now I'm kind of, like, you know, I'm started getting this kind of, like, What's a fucking movie with Don Wiener and, oh, Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Okay, right.
I'm getting this Welcome to the Dollhouse vibe. I'm, like, looking at her through her window in her bedroom, like, you know, dreaming of being a star, and then seeing the cold reality of her crying as she's walking home, and, you know, going back into her fantasy world in her bedroom. I'm walking by and I keep seeing, I'm like getting introduced to this world of rejection that she lives in. Sorry, Cindy, and if you're listening. And so, anyway, this is the climax of my story about Cindy, if you're ready.
Yes.
So this all comes back to the phone. So the phone was such a, like, intense, traceable, exclusive thing. If you were on it, you know, as a teenager, you were on the fucking phone. Your mom couldn't use it. It was, like, a big deal, and you fucking sat on it all the time at a certain age.
Yes.
And she came back to my room. My mom said, I don't want to accuse you of anything, but there's like $200 worth of, like, X-rated phone calls.
Wow.
And I was like, it was one of the only times in my life I didn't do it. Because I actually almost burned my entire school down. I did start a forest fire.
Wow.
And it was really a very intense thing, and that the police took me down into a leaky basement over the summer over and over and broke me.
How old were you?
They got me to tell the truth, and it was very difficult.
How old?
I was probably like 11 or 12.
But you, at first, you're like, I'm not going to fucking confess.
Oh yeah, it was hard. I walked in there super cocky, and by the time they took me for several interviews, and they destroyed me.
Okay. So,
but let me finish.
Okay, go ahead.
Cindy made all the calls.
How do you know it was Cindy for sure?
Because there was no, my mom knew what time the calls were at.
When would she have made the calls?
She made the calls when I went to bed when she was babysitting me. And my mom believed me instantly because it just made sense. Like, oh my God, like, maybe my mom could kind of see that Cindy was lacking in some areas and needed some romance, you know? She knew that I just, they had all made sense for some reason.
And so you would go to bed. You would go to bed. I remember the commercials that would come on for these, like, chat lines or whatever.
So alluring when you were a kid.
So it's almost designed for kids, if you consider the fact that when if you and I decide to start.
We should play one.
If you and I decide to start one of these ridiculous phone chat things from the 90s. And we're going to start this business, like psychic hotlines, for example. Mm. Like, you watch, you've called psychic hotlines before, right? Like, have you ever tried?
Actually, no.
So I did. I think I was in I think I was with a friend. We're like, let's just call this psychic hotline because it's free at first, right?
Okay.
But we realized very quickly, like, when you see a TV commercial, you think to yourself, oh, we're talking about a fucking warehouse of psychics. Like some kind of huge operation where it's just like bunches of people in cubicles pretending to be psychics, taking in money. You don't think this is someone's house. This is in someone's house. There's like three or four people and they're sitting there waiting for phone calls to come in, because when you're broadcasting out into the world with a psychic hotline, you aren't going to get much of a response. You're going to get maybe 3% response. But if you can get 3 or 2% response in a night with a ridiculous, weird shit that they charge, you're going to make enough to pay for the commercial plus a little bit of a profit. And you could do so. We started calling this number and like the same fucking person was answering. And then you realize like, oh my God, this is like one dude
right.
who bought this psychic hotline advertisement. And it's like, real, these are real bona fide psychics who will. And like, we call back and it's like, this guy's like, guys, listen, are you going to keep calling this number? Cause he is annoyed because we're, I guess, blocking all the other fucking prank callers who are, it's got to be like 70 prank calls and one elderly person who's like, you know, senile and a bunch of kids like, hey, it's my future. And then maybe one real person. So this is what's really odd about it is like these fucking hotlines there. It's like one or two people in their house and they know when they're coming up with their business plan, they're like, listen, all we need is for people to accidentally call this fucking thing, not pay attention to the beginning. Like, you will be charged $746 if you go over 3 minutes. As long as they can just ignore that or be demented or be hammered. You know, if you put an advertisement out past 3 a.m., everyone watching is hammered or insomniacs or crazy. Just sitting in a puddle of blood and diarrhea, surrounded by just the decapitated heads of different people that they've lured into their hotel rooms. You know, like, and they're like, fuck it, I'll call. What else do I have to lose? I just mouth fuck this decapitated head. Who cares? I'll use their credit card.
Sir, in the future, you're going to be arrested.
So yeah, that makes sense to me. They know 13-year-olds are calling. They know sixth graders are calling. They know that they're luring in these people and they're making money off of the like drunk and the deranged and the children, basically.
Yeah, what could be more depressing than knowing you're just literally a bottom feeding satanic leech? Like, knowing that, like, tricking people is one thing, but having to live with it must be so much sadder even.
Well, I mean, you got to be a very special kind of person, you know, because you would have to think to yourself,
like, you're really a cunning, like, innovator in the business world or something.
You probably at some point, you know, you're walking fucking home with your backpack on, weeping, and you thought to yourself, you know what? Fuck this world.
I'm going to charge other people to be miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. You just get broken. It's like the same in the amplification of it is superhero movies. The arch villain in some way or another gets broken. Like something happens that makes the arch villain abandon the classic Christian ethics. Mm. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Darth Vader who gives over to the dark side.
Right. You know what this reminds me of, man? I was having this conversation with, I'm sorry if I've said this on here before. I guess I can't even say who I was having it with. But a pretty like renowned spiritual teacher. And it wasn't Ram Dass. But he was telling me that like he had hung out with Carlos Castaneda in the at some retreat. You know Carlos Castaneda?
It's like kind of a transgressive type or what?
He wrote the books, Don Juan books about peyote shamans or what. But like, I in one of these books, the shaman that he's learning from, I guess that's Don Juan, like does this insane ritual where he plucks a lizard's eyeballs out and two lizards, you'd tear their eyeballs out, and from like ripping their eyeballs out and sending them off, you gain some weird, I don't remember the specifics, but I remember up until that point, I kind of enjoyed the book because the descriptions of like, I guess the peyote god's name is Mescalito or something, like the description of the peyote god, what he looks like and the weirdness of his form and all the psychedelic trip reports were really fascinating until it got to that point. And it's like, oh, this fucking shaman feels okay mutilating animals. I no longer want to read anything about this because I think his entire system is completely ridiculous. And at that moment, you realize that nothing he's teaching makes any sense. This is what I thought. So I said to this guy, I was telling him, yeah, I read the lizard plucking that lizard's eyes out. And he's like, Duncan, Don Juan was a sorcerer. they consider compassion to be the very lowest form of spiritual awareness, that higher than that is power, and that if you get stuck in the whole compassion realm, you're a neophyte, that you move beyond compassion into the higher realms, and that's where you enter into the, like, the you know, the Nietzschean, completely free, not burdened by the normal, ridiculous ethical system of the slaves who've been conditioned by the masters to function in this way because they're easier to control. The first thing you throw off is the bridle of the powers that have made you succumb to the weakness that you consider to be compassion, which is actually just weakness. And then, bam, now you're Darth Vader, because you're like, fuck this. Look, you want to play the game where you're going to succumb to my will? Then fine. I'm going to play that game with you because I want you to succumb to my will, because I can use you to do things that I want. And that's what I want to do in this life, is to have legions of people doing what I want, succumbing to my will. And so you meet people like that in real life, and these are the sorcerers, only they call themselves bosses now. But in the old days, they were sorcerers. We're always like, look at that fucking CEO. He gets a $2 million bonus every single fucking year while his employees are making minimum fucking wage. Who does he think he is? Well, I'll tell you who he thinks he is. A sorcerer, a powerful being that has enslaved a web of people and tricked them through his sorcery into thinking they're free. And you know what I mean? So that's how it fucking happens. Anyway, that's a tangent we got off on. That's how you end up starting a fucking sex line or a psychic line or becoming some bullshit clairvoyant or becoming Hitler or becoming like whatever, is just a general dismissal of the classic ideas of what it means to be good to the people around you. You replace them with a kind of a moral compass that does no longer... The true north of that compass has nothing to do with the golden rule and everything to do with making yourself more powerful.
So you're saying Cindy was a sorcerer?
She could have been.
True North. That's a good podcast title. What is that, a phrase? True North?
I think so, yeah.
That's dope. Well, yeah, I remember the same kind of similar experience. Crowley has a book called like Moonchild or something?
Yes.
I remember trying to read that among, like, Behold a Pale Horse and all these things that... I mean, some of which maybe you mentioned to me or something, but I remember it's kind of how you were struggling with the glass bead game, too. It's like you get about halfway through a book, and then it's in Moonchild or something. I remember Crowley is talking about, you know, you bury it... a geese egg in the ground underneath this and that, and you wait 7 days, you come back, you pull it out, you go bury it somewhere else, you say this over the egg, blah blah. I just remember being like, yeah, I don't need to read this shit anymore, man. Like, I just don't need to go through this. Like, I'm not addicted to ritualism. I want the straight dope. And
right.
As a musician or whatever I was at the time, day to day, I felt like I had my own portal into a world of what some people would call magic. But it didn't have anything to do with burying an egg and saying shit backwards over it. That I didn't need that.
Why are you saying it in the past tense? Don't you still feel like that?
Yeah, I'm just saying at the time, it was just like one of those moments where... I was like you, I just put the book down. I was like, I don't need this shit, you know, or whatever. I remember that feeling of being like, I'll take this and that and this, and I'll get rid of all this other baggage. You know what I mean? I think there's nothing wrong with that. Like hybridizing and taking what you really see the worth of something and then just like putting the rest of the book down, you know?
Yeah, totally. You don't have to, I mean, I think that's a, if you put the book, depends on the reason you put the book down for. And a lot of times when you put the book down, it's because it stops matching your expectation and it starts matching a different expectation. And that different expectation is too much for you to deal with because you want everything to be the way you think it should be.
I love that idea, but I think this was the reverse. It was like, It was like I came upon the shit that I didn't need. You know what I mean? Like the stuff that was in my way.
Well, this is the, I mean, I know exactly. I think you're right, mostly. Definitely right. But sometimes in these books, these things are placed there as force fields to keep people out. So
that's
like,
a cool idea.
There's like these like different, there are these different barriers that you put in where certain people are going to hit that barrier and like, fuck that. No way. Right. Some people, I can't even like the idea. A person as a meat eater, the hypocrisy of reading this like animal brutality thing, like using an animal for a different, for when you eat meat, you're using an animal for power. Like you're using its energy for power and you're using its suffering for power. And you're a dark sorcerer, whether you like it or not. And it's not like that being a sorcerer is some kind of novel thing. It's kind of a basic predatory function that exists in all many different forms of life on the planet, not just human beings. So, you know, but to hit that point, be like, fuck that. I can't deal with that. I'm not going to read that. I no longer respect Don Juan is more of a indication of where I was at the time, which is like, well, dude, A, it's probably fiction. B, if it isn't fiction, it's more of an account of a kind of delirious dream state that these people were putting themselves in to hit these certain transcendent peaks and plumb the depths of their subconscious versus like, were they actually flying or teleporting? By the way, when I asked, when I was talking to my friend about this, he's like, and the other thing, when I asked Carlos Castaneda about his stories of teleporting, he was like, yeah, absolutely. We did that for real. And then the other thing he said, the other thing that he told me is that he had a web around him of women. Like he had basically like pulled around him a group of women that were his like harem slash student slash devotees slash, you know, like he had really magnetized these beings to him for real to, as a demonstration of power. So, I don't know, man. I think that like there is a certain place that people like me get to, and I don't want to go past it. You know, there's like an area where it's like, all right, I like it here. But when you're burying a goose egg, for example, well, I mean, it's like some people will read that and they'll be like, you know what? I'm going to fucking try that. And then they're going to go do it in the middle of the night under a tree with a like, if you imagine really doing a ritual like that, imagine really doing it. What state you would be in when you were doing that ritual. Just think about that for a second. Like, what that would feel like, what, how amazing that night would be. You would never forget that night. First of all, I don't know where you get a goose egg, but like the trip to go get the goose egg, like, you know, like, I don't know what this ritual is, but let's just imagine the ritual is like, all right, you're going to bury the goose egg. So the trip to go get the goose egg, right? And then the trip to go get the goose egg is going to be an interesting trip. Because as you're driving to go get the goose egg, you're thinking, what the fuck am I doing? I'm going to get a goose egg to do a ritual. So that's going to be the most interesting errand that you've ever run in your life, right? And then once you get home with a goose egg, every time you look at it, you're going to realize you have entered into a brand new universe right now. The universe you're in right now is not the universe you used to be in, because sitting there is a goose egg that you're going to use for an actual magical ritual. Now your day is different, because every time you look at that goose egg, your subjective lens is shifted. It's warped a little bit. And then when you take that fucking goose egg and go bury it and do it, it doesn't matter the result of it, because you've already gotten the result, which is you just experienced a form of controlled insanity. You just did a kind of insane OCD thing. And no matter the result, which I'm sure there would be some fucking result, because the next day you're going to go outside and you're going to see a world that's the world after you did this ritual, you know? So in that way, it's like, I get it. We can discard ceremony. I've seen you drum. I've seen you drum. And I've thought to myself, yeah, that's some form of ritual magic there. I don't know what the fuck it is, but it's like, that's definitely more than just playing music. So I get it. You've got your own way.
Right.
But maybe people have their other ways.
Well, okay. You remember when we were up in northern India and we went to the community center in Dharamsala? We're up at night. There wasn't like a shitload of stuff to do in Dharamsala. Obviously, right. we lived there. It's where the, you know, Dalai Lama lives, and
sucks. We missed him.
It seemed like destiny at the time, but we stayed there for, we lived there for a month, right?
Yep.
And, we were teaching Tibetan monks and refugees English just for school, graduation hours.
Yes.
And, that's kind of beside the point, but at night there wasn't a whole lot to do. It was kind of slowly being turned into this kind of Richard Gere, branded, like, fashionable place to visit. So there was a lot of like really beautiful like Israeli girls there partying and like fucking the monks, and the monastery was falling apart.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, it was crazy. Not that we were like that embroiled in the monastery. We were more hanging out with the refugees who worked at this restaurant. I fell in like super hardcore with you had your student and I had my student, and we're really close, right?
That's right.
And, anyway, at night, so the, this is like the weirdest way to get back to your point, but, at night we go down to the community center and they had like an open mic night. And I remember being terrified to play music in front of people. I just didn't want to do it. But there was one night where I decided to do it, and we went up there, and I remember you kind of peering in through the window. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember this night. I remember how good you were.
It was really, really intense for me. And the crowd of people were like the most idyllic crowd. They were like really focused and
they hooked. Loved it.
It was really intense. And so then before I played and after I played, I actually have a recording of some of that somewhere. Before and after I played, like these little Tibetan dudes hopped up, and of course they play Hotel California, because all the way around the world, one of the most famous, you know, top three songs of all time in people's brain is Hotel California.
Yep.
And they play it with their cute little accents. You know, it's fucking hilarious or depressing, depending on how you want to see it. But my point is like, I don't really like the song Hotel California. I like a lot of Eagle stuff, but I don't like that song. But for some reason, they reached their hand inside a box that had nothing in it. And through magic, they pulled something out of nothing. And what it was some ancient kind of language in that scale, right? Whether you like it or not is not the point. It has nothing to do with anything. And a big part of what I think we're talking about is literal thinking. And then leaving behind literal thinking.
Yes.
And ritualism. And getting down to the true magic. What real magic is. So in other words, you know, like you always used to talk about the levels of the Masons, you know?
Yes.
And that was like really fascinating to me because I'd never read about the Masons. So one of the first things when we first met in 1996 or something.
Yes.
Is you would prowl around the Masonic temple. I mean, we'd be like looking in the windows trying to figure out, you know. It was such a mysterious world. But the one thing that always stuck with me is you would talk about the levels above literal thinking, right?
Yeah.
So people get stuck in these lower levels where they're like, oh yeah, ritualism is really the whole point, right? They wear the outfit, and then the higher levels, they abandon all that, right?
Well, I mean, there's rumors about it, but you could dig it up. Who knows, man? But you never know. I know Masons that I've met are really cool. And I know that like, pretty much hands down, They're pretty put together. They have some kind of like discipline that comes from whatever craft they're practicing. But so I don't know, man. I don't know what happens up there. You know, I think if I did know, I probably wouldn't talk about it necessarily, because out of respect for the people that I've met who seem to be engaged in that, and you wouldn't want to ruin it for somebody who is interested in making that progression. One thing I really find awesome about the Masons is that they ask you Do you know the question?
Well, this is the story you used to tell me, I think.
No, they say, are you a traveling man? You ever heard that?
Oh, no, I don't know this one.
Yeah, that's how a Mason will ask you if you're a Mason. They say, are you a traveling man? And I didn't know that, but somebody, I remember, came up to me after a show, and they're like, hey, are you a traveling man? And
that's like the coolest question.
I know.
You don't think they mean like celestial traveling?
Well, we don't know what it is, because just from my like pretty tepid investigation into it, really. I mean, if I had any kind of guts at all, I would just become a Mason. But my tepid investigation of the thing is that they're really into math, geometry, sacred geometry. I think that math or geometry is the language that God speaks through. And that by like analyzing that, and then if you look at like the idea of what it is, a Mason, a builder. So if you look at that, the idea is that, you know, in every single building are these, if a building should stand, and if a building is going to stand without collapse, then it must be based on very specific mathematical principles.
Okay. But let's get into the, like, the pulpy part that you used to seduce me with.
Spitting on the cross?
Yeah, but more importantly, like, you're talking about the world of rules. Like, to learn how to play like Ravi Shankar, you have to learn the rules. But then there's a world, the way you used to tell me about it, is like, there's a world above that that's lawless, right?
Well, this is the mystery. I mean, this is a thing that we'll never know for sure unless you were to like actually dive in there. My guess would be, yeah, of course, exactly. I mean, this is like, I think we have to refer to the Emerald Tablets and think of the saying, as above, so below. So if you've gotten good at anything, then maybe from that perfection or path to perfection, or even the experience of beginning down the path to perfection in anything at all, you can extrapolate from that probably a map that would apply to almost every single pursuit. So if you think about like, okay, you know, what do you hear like the great comedians say? Inevitably, they'll say at some point they realized all they had to do was just be themselves. But to get to that point, they had to follow this infinite slow progression, following rules. At first, you try to like adhere to these rules of stand-up comedy. You don't even, you know, someone's just commenting on a comedian they had watched and saying to me, well, it looks like they're just trying to do rules, like they're formulaic, you know, is the term, formulaic. And that's fine, you know, because formulas work. And if you're being formulaic and it gives you a place to get used to whatever, being on stage, but you keep being formulaic, then out of a general sense, usually of devastation, of just getting to the point like, I don't give a fuck anymore about what they think about me, I'm just going to say what I'm interested in up there, then suddenly that's when your real material starts coming. So I'm sure with music, it must be the same way. Eventually, like, what, you know, you like start off learning progressions, chord progressions, or music theory, or whatever that, I mean, I don't know enough about music to know, but then eventually you get to the point where you step on stage and you just start playing.
Right. So that's where I'm heading towards. Right, there's the world of the training wheels and looking at a map, and then there's a world of who's a Sierra Club dude.
I'm not sure.
I can't believe this. I'm drawing a blank on this. There's the world of the person that pioneers the map, that actually blazes the trails.
Yes,
right. Two very different things. So let's go back to sitting in the Dharamsala Community Center here in Hotel California. So one person reached into this void of potentiality and pulled something out of it that went on to become sort of like the paperclip, right? Something that everybody needs.
Yes.
That didn't exist before.
Right.
You have to respect that. That's crazy to be able to pull something like that out of the void, right? But then to be, you know, 30 years later, a guy named Harold that buys his first acoustic guitar and strums out the chords and is like, I learned Hotel California. That's two different things.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. I know exactly what you mean.
Okay, right. So the first thing that they entered like a Bermuda Triangle of a magical stuff, like a fundamental stuff, and they molded it into the shape, right? Doesn't matter what it is, exactly, yes. The song or whatever.
Yes.
That takes a level of self-sacrifice and dedication to find out what that thing's going to be and to craft it into something that is hopefully beautiful in the image of the earth, the galaxy, you know, something that God did, you know, these kind of weird things that we are. Like that, to give yourself to a process of going down that road is a huge thing, and to be able to render something and print out something so complex or beautiful is a huge undertaking, and it takes this kind of, it's a beautiful road, or it's a beautiful leap to make, right? But to just repeat it, to just pick up a guitar and repeat that thing. So that's what I'm going back to, is like putting the egg in the ground and doing a spell you read in a book.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The magic of being the person that was compelled, if your life was a Jodorowsky film and you were like performing this insane sacrificial ritual,
yes,
and you met Satan and you fucked him,
yes,
in the ass on a mountaintop.
Yes.
That's one thing. But if you just read a book about it, that's a totally different thing.
Well, I mean, I think we're talking about a very interesting concept, which is the continued application of a pattern over time,
mm-hmm,
with diligence can result in the dissolution of the self. So somehow by doing some practice, this is why I love chanting, because it's like very simple rules. It's say the chant and listen to the chant. So when you're chanting, you're listening to that chant. You're listening. And as you listen, you know, you hear it bend and warp, and you'll hear different pieces of it you've never heard before, even though you've been chanting it for years. It'll start making resonances you've never heard. Who knows? Maybe because you got an extra, you know, bit of coffee in your fucking throat. Who knows? But it's like, when you're listening, it's like, my God. This is a complex sound, man. There's way more to this than I thought. And then you get lost in that thought. And then you're like, wait, okay. No. I just need to listen. I don't need to think about it. I just need to listen. And you go back to that and back to it and back to this listening to the chant. And then over time, the more you go back to the listening to the chant and learn when your mind gets caught up in either contemplating how ridiculous the chant is, how absolutely stupid it is that you're chanting, or just about some shit you've got to do that day, or about how mystical you are, or about how you're, oh God, I must be on the brink of enlightenment here. This is really happening now. Eventually, you just stick with the chant. And in that state, you hit a place that isn't reflective anymore. That's just, you know, I've heard that it's called the Omkara or whatever, where you now are the chant. You now, the chant, you have turned into Hare Krishna. You are now the chanting of the millions or hundreds of thousands of, probably millions of people who at any given moment are chanting that mantra and have been chanting that mantra for a long, long, long time. So in that way, so that's the dissolution of the self through disciplined practice, and the result is a kind of blending in. And I think with art in particular, you know, it starts off with learning your chords, learning your, like, sitting. It starts off, it fucking hurts too, right? You start off and you're like, oh, I'm going to learn to play piano. And, oh, but I need to learn how to move my fingers on the keys in an easier way. Oh, shit, I need to learn how to, like, make this left hand follow the right hand in the opposite. So now the left and the right hand are moving opposite. What the fuck? How do I even do that? And over time, you do it over and over and over again and over and over and over again. Then when you hit the place, it feels good. Somehow your brain likes it. It's like, ooh, this is nice. This is nice. And you don't realize that when you're doing it, what you're doing is you're dialing in frequencies. And the frequencies that you're dialing in all have metaphysical corollaries based on the specific sound or even the story. White key, black key, white key, black key. Arbitrary colors, I know, but the dissonance, harmony, the slight shifts, you don't even realize what you're doing there is the fucking, the procreative functioning of the universe, the in and the out, the yin and the yang, whatever you want to call it. So, but then over time, the more you do that, eventually you become a piano player. And then eventually, the more you do it, eventually you dissolve. And then somewhere in that dissolution is your hands are running over the keyboard and you're not even thinking about it. Suddenly, that's when you pull the rabbit out of the hat and you've got this thing that comes out. It pops out and says, hello, you didn't do it. Okay, so that's fundamental practice, right, of music. Magic, okay, sure. You start and lay and you fucking go and bury a goddamn goose egg or whatever the particular magical
right, but eventually you write your own spell.
Yes.
Right.
But
right,
you
right.
start off with the first, you know, here's the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram. Mm-hmm. Here's what it means. Here's what each sound means. Here's how you intone each of these sounds and why these sounds exist and where they come from. And here's how you do it. And here's what you put on when you do it. And so, you know, when I sit down to learn, when I come in to the studio to learn Ableton, there is a feeling that is more than I'm going to practice. It's a weird, like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
What am I doing? And then you get sucked into a thing. And that feeling of being sucked in is the payoff. But with magic, I think it's so much more powerful in a way because what is the fucking payoff? Like, I can show you after a couple of weeks of fucking around with Ableton. Oh, here's what I figured out how to do. But after a couple of weeks of fucking around magic, what am I going to show you, man? That I'm an idiot? Like, what am I going to show you? You know, what am I going to show you except shit that's going to confuse you and shit that's going to make you look at me and think, what's wrong with you? You fucking drew a symbol on a piece of paper and jerked off into it and then set it on fire at the equinox? Why? And I think this is maybe where magic and music kind of go their different directions. Because with magic, this is one of the very most important rules of magic, which is shh, don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. And I think people hear that, shh, don't talk about it. And they think, oh, that's because it's so powerful. We don't want to poison the ears of the others who aren't ready. No, they're saying don't talk about it. Because if you fucking talk about it to the wrong person, they're going to say, what the fuck is wrong with you? Why are you going and burying eggs? And then you're going to miss out. You're going to miss out on the glorious power that comes from playing an invisible instrument that is not accessible to people who are existing in the rational world that you're talking about. I think that's the thing. You don't want someone to shut you down. Eventually, I think you can get to the point where you're like, yeah, like Crowley, I bury fucking goose eggs at night, bitch. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do say that he was like, his fault was that he was a typical exhibitionist, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't, people have so many different things. I think that is something that seems to be a little suspect, is that he was, like, bugling this shit out, and he was, like, you know, completely open-sourced, it seemed like. But then a lot of the stuff they say that he was bugling out was intentionally wrong or intentionally misdirection. Like, yeah. The Anarchist Cookbook that supposedly has recipes.
I'm not trying to be pretentious by just differentiating between peak experience and like being a fucking master of something. There's just two totally different things, and to not differentiate between those two levels of I guess, power and control over this void, this magic box or something, to be able to enter into it and come out with something practical versus just like reading a book and being like, well, step three says put a pinch of lemongrass. You know, it's just like they're two totally different things, you know.
Can I just say this?
Yeah.
And have you practiced, have you tried a magical ritual yet?
It's been a long time since I would have found myself in a world where I would think I might want or need to do that, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, the question is, and again, when I say this, I sound confrontational. I don't mean to at all, but because I get it, what you're saying. But the thing is, like, all commentary on magical systems that have been read and not practiced,
right,
is like commentary that's only halfway there. Because until you have done the thing in whatever form, as rudimentary as it may be, and it does, you don't need a fucking temple, and you don't need you could do it in any second, you know, but you need to do certain things that are more than just praying. You know, even though, again, like prayer and is a form of magic, really. And you know, like I don't do it anymore myself. But the times that I have done it and have been met with results in that moment that are fucking nuts and scary, like real scary, like your heart starts pounding, like what the fuck is this? Oh shit. Whoops. I guess this thing that for thousands and thousands and thousands of years people have been saying is real. What do you know? Oh shit, I guess my stupid ego that thought it understood the mechanisms of the universe at some fundamental level was absolutely wrong, and this fucking text advising me not to do this maybe was right. Because I've unleashed something in myself now, you know, something from my psyche, maybe something encoded into some deeper part of myself, maybe some epigenetic signal that's locked down unless you sit and like get incredibly fucking high and imagine the concept of the of north, south, east, and west having some kind of entities representing those directions. And what if that was like something encoded in us, and that when you do this thing and however you want to do it, you open it up for a second, and then suddenly the bubble that was your whole universe drops for a moment. It's just like DMT. You smoke DMT and it's like, well, I guess you were wrong, huh? I guess you were fucking wrong.
But isn't the point of giving yourself over to something like DMT, isn't the point sacrificing all expectation and sacrificing all... This is where I'm getting tripped up, is that Buddha left the castle, went out, you know, trying to be this, trying to be that. And it wasn't until the moment that he stopped trying where he was given knowledge, right?
I think it was the moment. I mean, isn't it? Doesn't the story go? It's the moment he was just like, I think he said, I'm just going to die. I don't care. I'll just die. I'll die if I don't get enlightened. I'm going to sit under this tree. And if I don't achieve awakening, and I'll just die.
But I can vouch for that. That works. Giving up, you know, and like being yourself. Going back to the source of all things, you know, within you, that's real.
Yes.
So that's where I'm getting tripped up, is like, if you're doing a fucking spell and you're like, and on the fourth day, I'll, you know, smoke nutmeg or whatever. It's like, doesn't that come with such a massive field of expectation to it? Like, I don't see how magical, like, that's greedy.
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of where magic diverts from the mystical, like, some of the world religions, where it's like, thy will be done, you know? I whatever you wish, oh great eternal love force in the universe, may it come through me. Whatever I want, who gives a fuck? It's just what something in my, you know, habituations and conditioning, you know, temporarily wants this thing. But whatever you want from me, may that be done through me. So that's like the prayer. But in magic, I think where it sort of diverts is it's like, yeah, it's greedy. I mean, a lot of these spells are just basic, like, hey, how can I make more money? How can I get laid? These are actually some of the most ancient spells.
Of course they are.
Love spells, money spells, and curses. Like, it's just all, so like where magic, and I think why some people consider magic to be polluted is because it is not the transcendent concept of an infinite, you know, infinite incarnations is addressed, I think, in many schools of magic. But there are like plenty of schools of magic that are like, look, if you want to fucking go off and be nothing, or you want to go vanish into God, go do bhakti yoga, do whatever. But I'm gonna use this system to create transformations in my subjective reality that are based on my egoic desires. And this is what we call, what we used to call magic, now we call it business. Used to put on robes, now we put on ties, but it's still no different. When a businessman is putting on his suit in the morning and doing his purification ritual and rubbing his lotions in and putting his tie on just right and going out into the world completely buttoned up, which is why when you walk down the street and you pass a businessman who's really a businessman, who's like really like his hair is perfect, his fucking everything's perfect, the way he walks is designed and developed to seem to exude power, and you pass a monk, you're going to feel an interesting feeling, which is like, these are different. I'm passing two different people. They both stand out. When I walk down the street, I pass a lot of different people wearing normal clothes. But when I pass a businessman or a monk, they have intentionally dressed themselves in ceremonial clothing to identify themselves to others and to differentiate themselves from the crowd. These are both different forms of magician. The businessman, of course, is not going to admit he's a magician, or at least he might. Some of them do practice magic, but he's not going to admit it. He's just going to say, well, I read How to Win Friends and Influence People, and I believe that if I wake up early every morning and have focus and discipline and believe in myself, and, you know, many of them are Machiavellian. You know, then I'm going to rise above the other sorcerers that wear the robes of the businessman. So I guess all I'm saying is, this is magic today. Magic didn't go anywhere. The wizards just stopped wearing robes, and a lot of them put on ties, and their goals became not turning lead into gold, but turning other people's life energy into money by making them think that their job is worthwhile, or making them think that, like, whatever the fuck it is that they're doing for the corporation, the cobble, the corporation slash cobble slash coven, shared intent, the corporation did, whoa, we're doing great this quarter, guys. That's just another way of saying the ritual is working. We are bringing in more energy.
Well, that seems to need a central differentiation. Like, there's a differentiation, like, I don't know what just happened.
Whatever.
Like, on one hand, there's a temporal magic, a greedy magic.
Yes.
It's like, I want to go take what I want. You know, I'm going to go dial 1-800, get my dick bigger.
Yes.
Wow. Great magic. Like, that seems pretty simple and not very magical. But then there's a realm that's much more, it seems to have much more depth to it, where you are giving up control. And
yeah,
you're entering into a real realm of complexity where you are not bringing in an intention. You know what I mean?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Like, isn't that's what you've already discovered making songs here at home, is like, real art is governed not by just trying to hammer out this assembly line, you know, thing that you already have envisioned, so much as submitting to the force and watching it become what it wants to be, right?
Absolutely. That's what I love. That's what you love. That's the form of magic we like to practice. That's the only, but I think some people just aren't into that. Some people want to exert their will on planet Earth to do very basic, non-sexy things. They want to bring in an oil well. You know, they want to fucking bring in an oil well.
Well, and those people are low-level Masons.
Well,
literally, they are Masons. They wear the ring and they go work on fucking bringing up an oil well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, and but many of these people, you have an expectation. Here's how someone who brings in an oil well is, right? And then you meet them and you're like, oh, fuck. This person is practicing high magic. This is not a low-level Mason. This is a fucking high-level Mason who's roller skating out in the outer fucking brinks of the universe, who is like, what anybody who looked in at this person would just think, yeah, he's got some fucking storefronts or whatever. And yet, when they start telling you stories about what their life is like, how many times they've almost died, how much danger they're always putting themselves in because they're always throwing themselves to the fringes of like where you should be because they're crazy. These aren't normal people. You know, we think about it and it's like, and by the way, I don't want to build up like Exxon executives. I don't know what they're fucking like. I've never met one. But you know, like when you look at people like a lot of these people that are these like moguls.
Like Howard Hughes or.
They're crazy.
Henry Ford.
They're crazy.
Yeah.
Like they are not. These are not tame animals. We like to think of them as like, I bet I could offend that guy with my fucking wild ideas about healthcare. But you get around them and they're beasts. This is why I love There Will Be Blood, because it's the collision between these two different forms of magic. One of them being the failed magician and the old, or representing the old power, the guy who doesn't really believe in God, who's trying to use it to manipulate people, and the new power. And, you know, which is why, if you haven't seen There Will Be Blood, turn it off for 10 seconds, but which is why the very ending is so potent, because he's beating him to death with a club, beating him to death. And he says, I'm finished, you know, which is like the final victory of industrialization over, you know, primitivism or whatever. And like, so when you look at that, you know, you're seeing like the archetypical, what they're really like. These are fucking killers, literal killers. We think, oh my God, don't you know you're ruining the environment? They're like, yeah, they might not care. These are, you know what I mean? These people are authentically wild, savage, dangerous sorcerers who have tricked us into thinking they're doing business when they're not. They're just high magic practicing. They live in towers. They live in fucking towers, dude. Trump Tower. They still live in towers. They love to live in fucking towers. Why? I don't know. But sorcerers like to live in towers. They like to have slaves. They like to fucking have golems. They are all, they have, and by their golem, the golem is the industry. It's their car factory. It's the Amazon warehouse. It's whatever, where the robots are rolling around. They animate matter to do their will. They enslave people hypnotically to do their bidding. This is, nothing has changed. It just looks different than it does in a Disney movie. Still the same. The sorcerers. But meanwhile, people like you and I couldn't do that if I fucking tried, because I'm not going to be able to take doing a layoff. I'm not going to be able to handle, like, you know what? We're going to have to fire 200 of you tomorrow just because I'm going to fire these people, these sorcerers. They will fire 200 people and then the next day take a check for $20 million and feel okay with that. $20 million. Those $20 million purely representing the life energy that the 200 people exerted into that corporation for the previous year. So these sorcerers, they don't fucking care. And
it really is beyond good and evil, yeah.
Well, yeah, you can't. I mean, like, can you imagine knowing Larry down in fucking, like, I don't know, maintenance, who's worked for the company for 25 years has like had a third kid who has Down syndrome and has to fucking like take care of this kid now, and like it's gonna need like extra money, and like he's maybe on the precipice of retirement or something like that. Whatever the story is, you know, something, you know, you kind of know about this going on. You know that there's hundreds and hundreds of people beneath you who desperately need this job. But you look at a fucking, like, your stock, and you see somebody comes in, and you're like, you know, if we can automate and get rid of, like, 200 of these people, or we could just move the job over to Mexico, and we're going to make an extra $100 million this year if we do that, which is going to make a bonus for you of $10 million this year. So can you imagine you, Emil, being like, yeah, do it. Fire him. I don't care if this fucking guy isn't going to be able to take care of his kids.
Well, but that's where I would say that, you know, the world of capitalism and the temporal world we sort of rat race through every day is like, it's like a kind of a pale shadow of the true world of spiritual ascendance. So this top dog boss dude who's doing that, you know, I'm sure he sees himself as like, you know, incredibly the emperor, the powerful black magician or something. But to me, I still have the right. I still get to look down on him because his form of magic is a pretty temporal, shallow beginner world compared to where you can really go, where you can really take yourself. So even though he has everything he's supposed to have, there's still like this monumental sadness fueling him to do that.
Okay, but let me become the wolf, okay? Mm-hmm. Now I'm the wolf. And what I would say to you is, oh, really? Oh, you think what you're doing is better than what I'm doing. I'm the wolf. I am nature. I am the embodiment of the primordial energy. Look into the world. What do you see? Do you see kindness? Do you see kindness when the lion takes down the wounded fucking gazelle baby? Do you see kindness in the hyena's eyes as it rips the elephant apart? Do you see kindness in an avalanche? Where do you see kindness? Do you see kindness in the sun giving people skin cancer? It brings life on the planet, but it kills people too. Where is this kindness that you embody? I am the wolf. I am the wild, rampaging wolf, and I do not have time or energy to pretend to be something I'm not. I am the wolf. I am the grinder. I am the darkness. Bow down to me.
Right, right. But that kind of entity, when you boil it all down from a higher perspective, I think is really just another tool being used by nature. I don't think they're a true independent. They haven't reached this point of total independence, a true spiritual autonomy.
No.
I think they're just another cog, really.
I mean, yeah, you're right. And also they're probably pretty fucking boring, really. I mean, they probably don't really like, I don't know though.
In your defense, surely there's been some like super hyper complex, you know, mercurial, fascinating, super bizarre, very strange people who have ascended into the world of business and success that are also, in addition to that,
yeah,
extremely complex and spiritually versed in their way. But let's say, do you remember this story about how my buddy, when he was like 9, there was a weird man at the end of the road at his house? And him and his friend used to get together and do chemistry together because they were good Christian kids.
Right.
And his...
What do you mean? Like chemistry set? They had a chemistry?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And him and his friend were excelling beyond everybody else. They were going home from class when, you know, none of us were even messing with chemistry.
Yeah.
And they were getting really good at it on their own terms.
Yes.
And this guy at the end of the road just started taking interest in... not my friend, but his buddy. And a few years went by, and he stopped seeing this kid more and more. It just, something seemed vague and a little confusing. And one day when they were near graduating high school. They were sitting in his room, and the kid just started crying and was like, I have to make a decision, like a really big, big decision, and I don't know what to do, and I'm not supposed to tell you about this. And my friend was like, you know, totally blindsided, like, you know, we're fucking 16 or whatever. What,
yeah.
What's going on? And the kid was like, I pretty much have to join the CIA, and I have to decide now, like right now. And this is my point. If you're watching people with potential and you're training, you're wanting to like find people with real potential, you would want to watch them young. And I mean, if I was running the CIA,
yes,
I would want to see all these high school kids' scores.
Dude, is this true? You really think the guy was in the fucking CIA?
Sounds yeah, like- he disappeared. He wrote him. He never saw him again. And he wrote him from Spain. He was pretending to be a bartender, studying the Basque, like, rebellion.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And because, you know, but bartenders just pick up tons of information. So he just became, like, this hub. I think that's how they introduced him into the community there. Anyway, I don't know anything about that. But my point is, like, if you were watching people, if you were at the top of the Masons, and you understood all of the mind states of all the different levels, and surely, like, a wolf, that's just one level, man.
Right.
You think the wolf runs the world? No. That's just a bulldog that they have out there running tasks. Right. You know what I mean?
That's cool.
So that's just one role. That's one little role. For the wolf itself to be inflated and feel like it's God.
Yeah.
That's just part of the plan.
That's cool.
So
trippy.
Yeah. So if you look down that hierarchy, look down that totem pole and look at the way that this whole organism has to work, you would want to be studying people with potential, right? But then you would need experts, people who understand the nature of different people's potential, right?
Yeah. So
some people have the potential to become, you know, Darth Vader. But there's an expert that knows that before that person knows that.
Right. That's so weird.
Right. So, you know, you're watching down this totem pole and you're watching these people grow up and you're cherry picking them out. You know when and you know where they should go, right?
Yeah.
So it's like you don't want to get mixed up on who is capable of what, right? And if I want to send you on a little menial task, maybe I'll tell you to go plant a fucking egg in the ground.
Yeah, right.
Maybe that's part of a joke I'm playing on you.
Yes.
But I already know if I'm this expert what you're capable of, right?
Sure.
And writing something in a book, telling you to go plant an egg, it doesn't really strike me as like the expert's technique.
I love it. I love it because you're adding in the community. You're adding into it. This isn't a solo thing, man. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
This is a hidden community-based process that's based on periods of initiation. Go fucking plant a million eggs in the goddamn ground, you eggplant exactly. Freak. It doesn't make any difference.
Totally.
Yeah, but if a person is like, that you meet, is like, it's time for you to go plant the egg, Emil. Plant that fucking egg. Yeah. Because you'll get in the CIA.
Well, that, I mean, you know, if I was running it, this is exactly how I'd be thinking about things. Because you want to be able to stave off people who think they're getting really high and you want to keep them in a place where, you know, they can actually serve you with some use. Right?
Let me tell you something right now. If I found out that you ran the CIA, that would be the best day in my life. Just so you know, that would be the best day of my life because suddenly you'd be like, oh, wow. Wow. If Emil runs the fucking CIA, then God, imagine what world we're really in.
We might make America great.
Oh, man. Well, dude, we got to close on that. Now I know you work for the CIA. Emil, always a pleasure, man. You got any dates coming up?
Holy Sons is about to go on an East Coast tour starting in Chicago on April 22nd. I can't believe I reeled that off that fast.
Nice.
And we're going to go all the way down to Atlanta. So, yeah, you can find those dates online.
April 22nd. That's 3 days after Bicycle Day, I think. It is. And three is the Trinity. So, thank you, Emil. That was intense. Hare Krishna.
Ooh la la. Thanks for listening, everybody. And a big thanks to SweetHarrys.com for sponsoring this episode. Remember, go to Harrys.com/Duncan for $3. You're going to get an amazing razor. Thanks, you guys, for listening. If you like the podcast, subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you're going to be in San Francisco or Los Angeles, I hope to catch you at one of these shows coming up. I love you guys, and I'll see you real soon. Hare Krishna.